Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on United Natural Foods v. the National Labor Relations Board, featuring Philip Miscamara. Philip is partner at Morgan, Lewis & Bockius and former chairman of the NLRB. Our moderator today is Pepper Crutcher, partner at Balk & Bingham. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Pepper, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Happy to do it. Folks, I'm your interviewer today. Philip is the interviewee, and you should pay attention to what Philip has to say, because he is the man on this issue. And let me explain a little bit why he is the man on this issue. The case he's talking about is a case he argued February 3rd of this year before the Fifth Circuit. And it shines an interesting light on a broader subject of the duty of the National Labor Relations Board and its unfair labor practice proceedings to respect the federal rules of civil procedure or not. Philip, you want to just at a high level explain what the issue is you and your counterpart at the NLRB are asking the Fifth Circuit to decide in this case?
Yeah, and I'll mention that it's great being here. The oral argument was held a week ago, Monday, February 3rd. And it may be helpful for those people in the audience that are not a lawyer just to also know what this case is about. This case has a history. It goes back 6 years. The time frame is important, and I'll just make two preliminary points. One, the underlying labor law issues in the case are, we think, very straightforward. This case originated with an arbitration award involving our client, United Natural Foods, or UNFI for short. The arbitration award involved two labor contracts that were negotiated by two unions that represented some employees at a warehouse in Tacoma, Washington. And the arbitration award required the company, UNFI, to apply the Tacoma labor contracts at a brand new facility that was twice as large, located roughly 60 miles away in Centralia, Washington. And at the new larger facility in Centralia, this is the important point from a labor law perspective, the two unions never made any showing that a majority of employees or any employees working in Centralia supported being represented by the two unions. So federal labor law prohibits any employer from recognizing a union unless there is a valid claim that the union was supported by a majority of employees and an appropriate bargaining unit. And in our case, because the unions never made a showing of support among employees at this new, much larger facility located basically an hour away in Centralia, UNFI filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board in 2019, stating that the union's attempt to enforce this arbitration award violated basic labor law principles. And the NLRB general counsel at the time, Peter Robb, in July of 2020, authorized the issuance of a complaint against the two unions. And we had a hearing that was scheduled for March of 2021. And then the second preliminary point here relates to why the time frame ends up being important in this case. The NLRB complaint was issued in July 2020 against two unions. President Biden won the November 2020 presidential election. And on January 20th, 2021, for the first time in history, the incumbent general counsel, Peter Robb, received an email 23 minutes after President Biden was sworn in, stating that if general counsel Robb did not resign by the end of the day, he'd be fired. And at the time, Peter Robb had 10 months remaining in the 4-year term specified in the National Labor Relations Act, Section 4D. So he declined the invitation to resign, and he was fired on January 20th. And then three things happened that were significant in our case. 5 days later, President Biden designated Peter Orr as acting general counsel. And then on February 1st, basically 5 or 6 days after that, we filed a motion for summary judgment that placed the merits of the entire case before the National Labor Relations Board. And then roughly 3 weeks later, on February 24th, the complaint was withdrawn, which effectively extinguished the litigation against the two unions at the direction of the new acting general counsel, Peter Orr. So we had two issues in the case, and we pursued these issues first with the NLRB, and then with the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, then with the Supreme Court, which ended up returning the case to the Fifth Circuit, resulting in the oral argument that occurred on February 3rd. And the two issues that we have pursued were these. The first issue is that a 1987 Supreme Court case involving the UFCW held that the general counsel's unilateral discretion to order a complaint's withdrawal ends when the case reaches the point of adjudication with the NLRB. And we argued before the board and the Court of Appeals that upon receipt of our summary judgment motion, the board at that point was required to evaluate the motion on the merits. That's an adjudication. And under the federal rules of civil procedure, and Pepper is going to talk about this in more detail, there's a rule, Rule 41A1, which says a plaintiff in civil litigation can dismiss an action without a court order only if that occurs before the opposing party files a motion for summary judgment. In our case, before the NLRB, of course, we filed a motion for summary judgment, and our position is that requires adjudication, and that means it's too late at that point for the general counsel to extinguish the case. The second issue in the case, which is an important one, involves President Biden's removal of General Counsel Peter Robb. And we argued at all of the levels, including the NLRB and then the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, that in the absence of cause, the president lacks authority to routinely remove the general counsel prior to the end of the 4-year term that's specified for the general counsel in one of the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act, which is Section 4D. And our position is, in relation to the general counsel, the act says nothing about the president's ability to remove the general counsel, which is in contrast with what the act says about the president's ability to remove board members, because a different section in the act, Section 4B, relating to board members, explicitly provides for the removal of board members for neglect of duty or malfeasance in office. And as most of you know who are participating in this webinar, there's also a theory dealing with the unitary executive, which at the present time President Trump appears to be pursuing to support the removal of any board member with or without cause. And that's something that's received a lot of attention by the Supreme Court. At the present time, in my Fifth Circuit case, that's a less important issue because that's not an issue that the Fifth Circuit afforded deference to in its prior decision. And I'll just say one last point in terms of where the case is procedurally. We had this case before the Fifth Circuit a few years ago. One judge, Judge Oldham, ruled for us on this summary judgment adjudication issue. The majority of the court, in an opinion that was written by Judge Higginson, said if they were deciding the issue of summary judgment adjudication de novo, meaning from scratch, they might agree with us, but they instead were affording Chevron deference to what the NLRB decided. And Chevron deference involves the principle that administrative agencies should get deference from courts of appeals, even if the court, left to its own devices, might decide the issue differently. Well, so as it turned out, in the prior Fifth Circuit case, even the majority opinion that was decided against us said if they were going to decide the case, the issue themselves, they might agree with us. And we had argued, we preserved our position that Chevron deference should be eliminated in our prior appearance before the Fifth Circuit. As it turned out, the Court of Appeals was divided 2-1 against us in the prior decision. We filed a petition for certiorari for review by the Supreme Court, and we asked the court to hold our case until after the court decided the Chevron deference case that the court ended up adjudicating in Loper-Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. In the Loper-Bright case, the Supreme Court eliminated Chevron deference and overruled Chevron. And then 4 days later, the Supreme Court granted cert in our case, vacated the Fifth Circuit decision, and then returned our case, remanded our case to the Fifth Circuit for reconsideration on that question of Chevron deference in relation to the summary judgment adjudication issue. So at this point, the Fifth Circuit was not directly reviewing the second issue in the case, which remains an important issue. They were focusing on the summary judgment adjudication issue. But we're still actively pursuing both issues in the case, including the question of whether the president has the ability to routinely remove the general counsel. But that's not something that received significant attention in the oral argument that was held a week ago Monday.
All right. Before we get even weedier here, I need to go backwards and explain to people who aren't familiar with the magical mystery tour of NLRB adjudication. There are some significant differences you need to understand before we move on to the next subject of our discussion, and that is how the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure relate statute and regulation to NLRB administrative adjudication. So Section 10B of the National Labor Relations Act, and for you, those of you who aren't among us, 29 U.S.C. Section 160B says that the NLRB in its unfair labor practice proceedings shall apply the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, so, quote, so far as practicable. A board rule, 102.39, in Title 29 of the CFR, says the same thing. However, despite the content of Rule 56 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure governing summary judgment, another board rule, 102.24, says that when responding to a motion for summary judgment, a party, a non-movement, does not have the Rule 56 burden to come forward with admissible evidence showing there's an issue for trial, even if the movement has come forward with admissible evidence showing there is not a factual issue for trial. And the consequence for that is that when you file a motion for summary judgment against the board's general counsel, the board of general counsel can beat your summary judgment motion simply by saying, well, we alleged it. They can stand on conclusory allegations of the unfair labor practice complaint and beat your summary judgment motion. Now, that's because the board has never liked the language that's in Section 10B. It started ruling early in its history that is just advisory. It's guidance. It's not meant to bind the board, certainly at least in its pre-hearing procedures. If you want to go find the cases on that, it's Armstrong Cork in 1955, Component Bar Products in 2016. And so as a result, the board can follow or not follow the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, at least in its pre-hearing procedures. However, if you think the rule is going, that doctrine is going to apply the same to you as a respondent before the board, you might be unpleasantly surprised. For example, as recently as October 10th, in a Starbucks case, Administrative Law Judge Ross ruled that if you're a respondent, you receive a subpoena, and you want to raise an attorney-client privilege objection, you must comply strictly with Federal Rule Civil Procedure 26 and serve a detailed privilege log, else you have waived that objection. So the board picks and chooses when to comply with the federal rules, Rule 56 and other rules. And when it does and when it doesn't, tend on average to significantly disfavor respondents before the board. Now, let me say one more thing before we get real weedy here about how this differs from federal civil litigation. If you are, you represent a discrimination claimant and you persuade the EEOC to sue on your behalf, your former employer, and you intervene or you file a separate complaint in a consolidated action so that you're there with your client and the EEOC is there right alongside you. And then the EEOC decides at some point, you know, we don't think this is our fight and they want out. They can get out with the court's permission, but they can't deprive you of your right to have your claim heard in that case. And what we're arguing about here, what Philip just told you, is the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board in that analogous situation says, not only do we have the right to decide this is not a fight we want to fight, we have the right to end the fight and deprive you, the other litigant, the charging party, of your right to have the board adjudicate your case. Now, back to the weedier issue of when does adjudication start for purposes of this doctrine of when the general counsel's discretion to end the litigation ends. And the board's position on that, Philip, is what?
Well, the board's position in our case was that the general rule remains that the general counsel can order a complaint to be withdrawn, basically extinguishing the litigation, unless and until the hearing starts before an ALJ. And that's the principle that was applied in our case. In general, that principle makes sense. It was upheld in this UFCW case, which had nothing to do with summary judgment. If you have a normal case that's perking along, at the point that you end up having an administrative law judge hearing that starts, and especially if evidence has been introduced in the hearing, that's too late for the prosecuting attorney to say, never mind, even though I issued the complaint, we're going to now extinguish the case at our initiative. And you know, that's the principle the board applied in our case. Of course, our response was, there's never going to be a hearing in our case, given that we filed a motion for summary judgment. And if the motion for summary judgment has merit, then that's going to dispose of the entire case. That's why the filing of the motion for summary judgment constitutes just as much of an adjudication as when a hearing starts in a normal case that doesn't have a summary judgment motion filed.
And the board's counter to your argument was based on precedent, right? And the precedent is not exactly on point. It's analogous. And you persuasively argued that you can see it in a different way than the board sees it. How did that part of the debate go?
Well, you know, the question that came up during the most recent oral argument was, well, we have this Supreme Court case. And the Supreme Court decision, again, which had nothing to do with summary judgment, in the course of deciding a different context, which was a general counsel settlement of the case, which was done before the start of the hearing. The Supreme Court reviewed that and said, well, we agree with the board's decision that until the hearing starts, there's no adjudication. Therefore, the general counsel can direct the withdrawal of the complaint in the context of settling the case as long as it occurs before the hearing. Now, in our case, there was no hearing. A hearing had been scheduled. It hadn't taken place. But the way NLRB the rules are construed, whenever you file a motion for summary judgment, it goes right up to the 5-member NLRB, or sometimes 3 or 4 members. But it skips the ALJ phase, goes up to the NLRB, and the full NLRB is evaluating the motion on the merits. And so for that reason, our argument most recently in the session with the Fifth Circuit that occurred on February 3rd, I made the point that there's actually more of an adjudication that is of greater value and that pushes the case further along in the process when you have a summary judgment motion filed with the full board in Washington, D.C., than you have at the start of an ALJ hearing where the average case is still 2 to 3 or 3 to 4 years away from even reaching the NLRB or being decided by the NLRB.
Now, there were in that argument, I expected the question to be asked. And frankly, I thought just Judge Oldham was probably saving it for a zinger at the end, but nobody ever asked it. I understand why you wouldn't want to raise it, but why didn't somebody on the panel, in your opinion, ask the board's general counsel, the summary judgment procedures as understood by the National Labor Relations Board so favor the general counsel that it seems to us all you had to say was, well, we allege it and you beat the summary judgment motion. Why didn't you just do that?
You know, in that's a good question. It's never been effectively answered. The general counsel, the acting general counsel's objective in our case was to simply extinguish the case and not permit the board to evaluate the merits of our motion.
But, well, let me ask the question this differently. Could not the general counsel, consistent with its own theory, have amended its complaint, which controls you? You don't get to decide what the complaint is, right? Could they have amended their complaint in a way that would have resulted in the denial of your motion?
Well, I think they could have, but the other thing that I would say, Pepper, is even without amending the complaint, if they had simply responded to our motion for summary judgment and said the motion should be denied because the NLRB in its long history always denies employer motions for summary judgment, regardless of whether there are disputed or undisputed questions of fact, because in the board's jurisprudence, having a hearing is always better. And as you know, because I know you have pulled the cases in which I dissented while I was serving on the board, the board's practice in, the board's uniform practice in all of the summary judgment cases that I adjudicated was to deny summary judgment and have a preference for a hearing whenever the general counsel opposed a motion for summary judgment. You know, even if the general counsel's opposition simply said we should have a hearing because a hearing would be better, you know, or we should have a hearing because the allegations that are in the complaint are disputed. And of course, if that's the standard, if you are going to deny summary judgment every time there's actually any kind of dispute between the parties as to the law, you would never have summary judgment granted. The board might as well just write the summary judgment procedures out of its rules and regulations.
Let's remind our audience, we're talking about an unusual situation that's the equivalent of a plaintiff summary judgment motion in a federal district court. That is this case. And we're looking at it from both sides. So the question I raise is, couldn't the union have done what the general counsel normally does and says, hey, fact issues in dispute, we said so in our answer, and beaten the summary judgment motion? Or couldn't the general counsel have said something that, no, we control the theory of the complaint, and this is our theory, and it doesn't match your motion, therefore don't dispose of this. We need a hearing to decide which theory is right. And that would have beaten the summary judgment motion. But instead, the general counsel decided neither one of those will work for us. We just need to snatch this thing back from the board and not let them rule on it. Have I understood that correctly?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And let me just clarify. I believe our motion for summary judgment had merit and should have been granted. So when I say that the general counsel could have prevailed just by opposing the motion, I'm relying on a long history of NLRB cases where the board, I believe, incorrectly has denied motions for summary judgment just because the NLRB doesn't take seriously or has not taken seriously the process of adjudicating cases based on summary judgment, unless there's one exception. In a technical 8A5 case, if an employer has a certified union and in a representation case, and then the employer refuses to bargain, which is the only path that you can get an appeal from decisions made in the representation case. In that case, the general counsel responds to the employer's refusal to bargain by filing an unfair labor practice complaint and then filing a motion for summary judgment that basically says, there's no dispute here that the employer refused to bargain. This is the path by which the employer gets a court of appeals to review the representation case rulings. And then the board routinely grants those general counsel motions for summary judgment. But in a regular unfair labor practice case where there are actual factual events that contribute to a finding that a violation of the act did occur or a violation of the act did not occur, the board almost never, and during my tenure on the board, never to my knowledge granted a party's motion for summary judgment. Those were uniformly denied. And that's one of the reasons why in a succession of cases, I dissented from the board's refusal to either grant summary judgment or at least issue a notice to show cause so that the parties would have to file a more meaningful response to another party's motion for summary judgment.
So for those of you who would like to look these cases up, my favorite three of those dissents are the LaHoist, LHOIST, North America case in 2015, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society case in 2016, and the Glass Fabricators case in 2017, which I have summed up in talking to others about this subject as member Miscamara saying to his fellow members, come on, man. The party filing the summary judgment motion did everything we asked them to do. Show us that there's no issue for trial and that they're entitled to a judgment in their favor as a matter of law. And we let the opposing party say, we want a trial, and they get a trial. But that's basically what happened, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the unfortunate thing about this is if you take, for example, a work rules case, the board has had dozens, I think at this point, hundreds of decisions where if an employer has a confidentiality agreement or if the employer maintains a code of conduct that requires employees to foster harmonious interactions and relationships with one another, there have been a lot of cases that say that type of a work rule or a code of conduct or an employee handbook provision violates the act because it interferes with some type of protected conduct that employees may want to engage in. Well, there's no factual dispute in those cases, and the board has had dozens and hundreds of those cases. There's no factual dispute. The rule says what it says. These rules are typically evaluated on their face. And there's no reason that a case like that needs to spend 2 or 3 years going through an administrative law judge hearing when the issues are ripe as soon as a complaint issues for the board to simply decide, you know, does the language pass muster? Is it lawful? Is it sufficient? Or is it unlawful in terms of its restriction against potential protected rights? And, you know, I used to say when I served on the board, parties cannot afford to win NLRB cases because of the length of time it takes just to get through the process. So, you know, summary judgment plays a very important role in other types of civil litigation when you're in the courts. And my position in some of the cases that Pepper described was, as long as we have rules and regulations at the NLRB that provide for summary judgment procedures and the identical standard governing summary judgment, which is whether a disputed question of material fact exists or does not exist, the board should treat summary judgment motions with the same seriousness that the board treats cases that go through the ALJ hearing process, and then there is subject of exceptions filed with the board. But that has not happened.
If I'm about to ask you to divulge litigation strategy, feel free to tell me to mind my own business. But another thing that I thought would come up, and I think you baited the NLRB to argue, when you analogize to Rule 41 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, I thought you were baiting opposing counsel to come up with, well, that's a federal rule. We don't consider that practicable. The statute only requires us to follow the federal rules so far as practicable, and it's not practicable in this context for these reasons. Was that what you were doing?
Well, you know, it's conspicuous in our case that the NLRB and the union, neither of them indicated why the rule that applies to civil litigation was not practicable to be applied in our case. Because the it's true that rule section 10B in the Act says that the rules of civil procedure shall be applied to the extent the language is so far as practicable. Because of that wiggle happens to be in the language, I indicated in my oral argument that without question, that language in the Act favors our position. But we thought the most direct and straightforward way to look at our case was we filed a motion for summary judgment that put the merits of the entire case before the 5-member board in Washington, D.C., the 3, 4, 5-member board in Washington, D.C. The board's rules require that motion to be evaluated on the merits. Evaluating a motion for summary judgment on the merits constitutes an adjudication. And the Supreme Court in the UFCW case held that when the NLRB engages, it exercises its adjudicatory authority, then that curtails the general counsel's ability to unilaterally extinguish the case by ordering the withdrawal of the complaint. And I think both of those things are true. What I just said, I think, is true, but it's also true the NLRB and or the union in our case should have explained why it was that just adhering to the federal rules was not practicable, and they failed to do that.
So I'm asking you to spill some beans based on your experience on the NLRB, because I expected Judge Higginson to ask you, well, if the board didn't care that the general counsel did this to its complaint, why should we? And I suspect there's some internal board reason why the board may not have a procedure to deal with this problem, or why it doesn't care. Do you know anything about that?
The only thing that I can say is that there's a reason that my dissenting opinions dealing with summary judgment in the cases that you mentioned were dissenting opinions. The NLRB has never really adjusted or revised its rules and regulations so that summary judgment procedures are taken seriously by the board. In our case, when the issues that we've been discussing got to the NLRB, and they did, the NLRB simply applied the statement in the NLRB's rules and regulations. It's section 102.18 that says a complaint may be withdrawn before the hearing by the regional director on the director's own motion. And that language has been interpreted to mean the regional director, as ordered by the general counsel, can do whatever it wants, including withdrawing the complaint prior to the hearing. The interesting thing in our case was that the dissenting judge Oldham, who agreed with us in the decision issued several years ago by the Fifth Circuit, and he clearly agreed with us in his questions from the bench during the oral argument that was held a week and a half ago, he noted that the language in this NLRB rule section 102.18, it says a complaint may be withdrawn before the hearing by the regional director on the director's own motion. And that seems to suggest that means the regional director can't simply withdraw the complaint. The regional director has to file a motion to withdraw the complaint. And that means the motion needs to be evaluated by the board, which didn't happen in our case.
And which would square it with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure Rule 41, correct?
Yeah, exactly. You have two sides that are filing a motion. The regional director, as ordered by the general counsel, could file a motion to simply have the complaint withdrawn. And we had a pending motion for summary judgment. And then the board would be in the position of evaluating both motions. But in this case, the board held that the board actually didn't evaluate anything except to uphold the interpretation that the regional director could extinguish the case at any time it wanted prior to the start of hearing. And in the absurd outcome, if you extend that logic, is if our motion had merit and if the board decided the case in our favor without having any hearing, then that would mean there never was any adjudication the way that the word adjudication has been used in these cases. And that's an untenable outcome. Adjudicating a case and deciding the merits of a case based on summary judgment is every bit as much an adjudication as if the board decides the case after it's gone through a hearing before an administrative law judge and then evaluated exceptions filed from that decision.
Now, if I had never practiced labor law and I were listening to Pepper Crutcher and Philip Miscamara have this discussion, I would think I had gone through the looking glass and this can't be right. So I suppose we'll have some questions, and it's about questions and answer time. Philip, do you have anything else you want to say before we turn to those questions and answers?
No, I'm happy to answer some questions. I will just say that the timing of the hearing that occurred a week and a half ago on February 3rd was difficult for the NLRB because at the time there was no acting general counsel. There was no general counsel, nor was there an acting general counsel. And, two of the judges, Judge Higginson and Judge Oldham, both asked the attorney representing the NLRB, who do you represent here? And has the general counsel changed their view regarding this case? And those were questions that were difficult for the NLRB to answer because at the time of the hearing, at the time of the oral argument, there actually was no acting general counsel at the board.
I must say, I thought your counterpart did a very good job with the argument she had available to her. But that one clearly came out of left field and she gave the only answer she could, which was, I'm in the enforcement division. This is my job. I was told to go do this and I'm doing it. That's all I can say. I can't tell you what the current general counsel position is. I don't know, but I'm here legitimately on behalf of the board.
That was her response. And I was asked, by Judge Higginson, has the acting general counsel turned over at the board? And my response was, the acting general counsel has turned over or is in the process of turning over. And as it turned out, within about 30 minutes after the conclusion of the oral argument, the President Trump designated Bill Cowan, the regional director for Region 21 in Los Angeles, to be the acting general counsel. But those two things occurred almost in real time, simultaneously.
All right. We are now looking for questions from the audience. Do we have any questions? Philip and I promise you could spend several more hours discussing this. What you have gotten here from us so far is a thumbnail sketch of what we think on these issues. If you'd like to see in more detail what Philip thinks, you can go read his dissents, which are published by the National Labor Relations Board. Or you can go see the law review article published in the Mississippi Law Journal in 2023 that I wrote on the subject of the extent to which Rule 56 actually binds the board in its unfair labor practice proceedings. And you can guess the position that I took in that. And I'll be happy to answer questions about that if you'd like. I have a chat, but not a question. Okay. Looks like we have a few questions, but my question in the window is not showing questions, oddly.
Yeah, I'm also seeing the chat feature, but I'm not seeing, which indicates there are questions, but I'm not seeing the questions themselves.
So, Federal Society Host?
There's a Q&A, excuse me, Pepper. There's a Q&A separate from the chat feature. If you go over three.
That's where I am, and it's not showing any questions. So, Marco, if you were actually seeing questions from our several dozen participants, would you tell us what those questions might be? Because we can't see them on our link.
Yeah, we have one question. What about jargassy regarding the board's refusal to hear summary judgment cases?
Okay. Well, Philip, you want to take that first?
Yeah, I'm not sure that jargassy specifically addresses that. Although, ironically, and I've always said jargassy, which I think is the wrong pronunciation of the name, but the Fifth Circuit decision in jargassy actually indirectly supports our position that the President Biden lacked the authority to routinely remove former General Counsel Peter Robb, because at the Fifth Circuit, and jargassy, I'll mention for everyone, is a case that also originated in the Fifth Circuit, went up to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court in the jargassy decision issued a very important opinion about the extent of permissible damages. And the court held that if an administrative agency awards damages that exceed make-whole relief, basically get into the realm of legal relief, that violates the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial, which can only be conducted by an Article III court. That's very important. But there's another piece of the jargassy Fifth Circuit opinion dealing with the Securities and Exchange Act and whether Securities and Exchange Commissioners can be removed by the president. And the court's decision indicates that they cannot be removed by the president, which is in conflict with how that issue was resolved by the Fifth Circuit in, you know, in our case.
I have a new question that actually hits close to home here. Question is, many practitioners think that summary judgment is a dead letter at the NLRB because some want all cases determined on witness credibility in order to insulate the decision from review. And then the questioner goes on to relate a seemingly absurd case that he had in which credibility of one witness who was inherently incredible was used as a basis for ruling against his client. I hesitate to ascribe bad motives to people who I don't personally know unless I have really strong evidence of the bad motive. And I and Tammy McCutcheon and Chris Murray and Alex McDonald have spent the last 14 months analyzing 314 NLRB administrative law judge decisions, looking at this as well as other issues. And I hope that'll be published sometime soon. It's about 50 pages and about 150 footnotes. But what I can tell you from that is there is good reason to suspect that that's going on. That is, some ALJs in some cases do seem to lean heavily on witness credibility, especially when ruling against employer respondents. And again, I don't want to impugn the motives of any particular ALJ, but there is reason to suspect, based on that evidence, that there is a systemic problem that needs a systemic solution. I agree with the questioner that that is the practical effect of not being willing to treat respondent summary judgment motions seriously. That is, they then go into an evidentiary hearing in which adverse credibility determinations can and sometimes often do determine the result. Philip, what's your analysis of that?
Well, I think that the summary judgment procedures provide for the possibility of having declarations and affidavits submitted with summary judgment motions. And in one of the cases in which I dissented, this was the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society case. Which included sworn declarations, an appendix that included the employee handbook provisions and various pages of emails. And I agree, this is kind of the premise of the question. I agree that the mere existence of witness testimony that ends up supporting summary judgment doesn't automatically convert the issue into one involving credibility. And so if you have a single witness who testifies at the hearing and there's no contrary testimony from any other witness, I think that's evidence which is unrebutted, regardless of whether you believe or disbelieve the witness in question. It's unrebutted evidence. And same thing in a summary judgment motion where there are declarations from one or more witnesses. The fact that those witnesses might be disbelieved if they were to testify at a hearing, I don't think is enough to warrant denying the motion for summary judgment. I think the party opposing a motion for summary judgment has a burden of establishing some dispute as to particular facts that potentially affect the outcome. But it's for sure the case that in opposing motions for summary judgment, the general counsel would, the oppositions filed by the general counsel often make reference to the possibility of credibility disputes that might emerge if a hearing is conducted. But that puts the cart before the horse. I think that you still have the board's duty is to still fairly and dispassionately evaluate whether there should be a hearing. And that requires an adjudication of the summary judgment motion on its face.
Next question is, are there other federal rules of civil procedure that the board does not follow? I have a favorite. There are some board cases in which the general counsel essentially claims that the employer engaged in a sham transaction, a civil fraud, in order to avoid an obligation under the National Labor Relations Act. And there are cases in which an employer faced with a charge claims that it's not what you think it is. This wasn't a legitimate request or demand or position of the union. They were engaged in a fraud. Here, let me explain it to you why we shouldn't have been required to respond to that as you think we should have been. And it was the union that was engaged in bad faith, not us. And in those two classes of cases, the board has traditionally said that the general counsel's complaint against the employer is not required to plead fraud with specificity under Federal Rule Civil Procedure 9, but the employer's defense to the charge based on the union committing fraud against the employer must plead fraud with specificity under Rule 9. And those two classes of cases don't talk to each other. And if you cite them back to the board, and I have done it, I have gotten a spam summary denial, no explanation, a ruling. So, yes, there are cases in which the board either doesn't apply the federal rules or applies them differently to the parties before the board. Philip, are you aware of any other examples? Well, Rule 26, discovery. Rule 33, Rule 30.
I would just... Yeah, deposition. Tim, you can go, if you compare the board's rules and regulations on the one hand, and then the rules of civil procedure that apply in the federal district courts, I mean, there are many, many differences. And some of them are in the nature of streamlining, given that the NLRB doesn't follow the discovery practices that are applicable in the federal courts. But, you know, some of them are in the nature of streamlining, and some of them are in the nature of, I think, more haphazard litigation. And but the treatment of summary judgment, that's kind of a level one fundamental issue in terms of how NLRB litigation proceeds. And, you know, there are many, many different subsidiary issues where the rules of evidence, the rules of civil procedure differ from NLRB practice. And that's a source of frustration, I think, on an ongoing basis that affects all of the parties that appear before the board.
Another question, the court's recent ruling, and I take the questioner here is, speaking of Starbucks versus McKinney, the court's recent ruling requiring the board to comply with Rule 65's injunction standards in 10J cases suggests an argument to require the board to comply with other rules of civil procedure. Do you see it that way, Philip?
I think directionally, yes. And the fact that the NLRB previously in about half of the circuits would go in to seek an injunction, which all of the federal district courts regard as extraordinary relief, and essentially say that the court's role was reduced to a rubber stamp of what the NLRB sought. You know, that was soundly rejected by the Supreme Court in the, you know, the Starbucks 10J injunction case. And I think directionally that moves towards greater uniformity, especially on these more fundamental issues. And certainly getting injunctive relief is one. The treatment of summary disposition of cases, which has received a lot of attention in some important Supreme Court decisions. That's another one, I think, that has fundamental importance.
I know the regional director involved in that case, and I was sad that her name got tagged on that because she was just effectuating board policy, and it's sad that future labor law students are going to be taught that Kathy McKinney was the big loser in that. I don't think she was. I think it was an institutional issue, and not a problem with her particular regional director. Any other question? Yes. Okay. The questioner says, to a certain extent, isn't liberal summary judgment practice a quid pro quo for liberal discovery, such that absent pre-hearing discovery, summary judgment would have to wait until the board's presentation of evidence? Oh boy, we could spend the rest of the day on this one. It is true that a respondent in a board proceeding cannot do what a defendant in a federal civil case can do, which is use a summary judgment motion under Rule 56 to smoke out any evidence the plaintiff was planning on concealing for trial. That is absolutely true. The difference is that in board proceedings, there isn't any other way to get the evidence either. Right?
Yeah. And I think the question is an interesting one because I think it implies that in order to have an active summary judgment practice before the board, there should also be discovery so that one party or the other is not prejudiced by failing to see what's under the tent on the other parties through discovery procedures. And, you know, my reaction to that is as long as the NLRB has summary judgment procedures, then including rules that use the same standard about genuine dispute as to any material fact, I think that's separate from whether or not there are discovery procedures that are available. And of course, at least if you're approaching a hearing, the parties have the ability to subpoena documents, and that in certain respects kind of is a substitute for discovery. But I think summary judgment, if it's in the rules, the board has to adjudicate it the same way, even though there's not more vigorous discovery that's permitted under the rules. And by the way, I expect some parties at some point to raise the question of whether or not the board should be required to adopt more substantial discovery practices consistent with what the rules of civil procedure provide. But so far that hasn't happened.
I expected a case to come up already saying the board should require initial disclosures. Rule 26A initial disclosures, they're practicable. Why wouldn't you? Doesn't mean you have to allow the rest of discovery. Why wouldn't you do essentially that? If you plan to use an exhibit at trial, you should produce it initially under Rule 26A, ask the administrative law judge to rule on that, and appeal the administrative law judge if he or she denies the motion. But I haven't seen that happen. Have you?
I have not. But I expect at some point that those types of issues are going to be brought up by parties, and the board's going to be put in the position of having to address those.
We are bumping up against 1 hour of your time that we have consumed, and I hope you think we haven't wasted it. For those of you who practice labor law, this should have been fun. For those of you who don't, I'm sure it's head spinning. Any other questions? All right, then, ladies and gentlemen, I think we are concluded, and we thank you so much for attending and listening to us talk about our favorite subjects. Philip, yeah, thank you again.
Pepper, thank you. And everyone, have a good rest of the day and rest of the week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.